And the surrounding area appears to be the hardest hit spot in the state after a deadly tornado swept through on Friday. State Emergency Management Director Eric Gibson says it'll take a very long time to recover.
Many metal buildings around the airport hangars are destroyed. A lot of commercial businesses are destroyed, but the tragedy is in the homes. The number of homes that have been destroyed in the Commonwealth is greater than you can imagine.
Tornadoes are blamed for 27 deaths in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia. 18 were in Kentucky, and most of those were in Somerset, about 75 miles south of Lexington. The day after a tall ship collided with New York's Brooklyn Bridge, we're hearing the first fire department radio calls reporting trouble, courtesy of Broadcastify.
The Brooklyn Bridge or Manhattan Bridge? It looks like it hit the Brooklyn Bridge and has drifted under the Manhattan Bridge.
Early reports said the tall ship's pilot said he had lost power and control of the ship. The NTSB is investigating the crash, which killed two crew members and injured 19, all hit by falling debris from masts that were too tall to clear the bridge. Officials say the Mexican ship was supposed to be headed in the other direction, out to sea. The new Pope's first official mass has included this message as heard through an interpreter.
With the light and the strength of the Holy Spirit, let us build a church founded on God's love, a sign of unity, a missionary church that opens its arms to the world.
Israel says it's launched extensive new ground operations in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian officials say airstrikes have killed at least 103 people, including dozens of children. CBS's Deborah Patta in Tel Aviv.
Doctors have told us they are barely able to treat starving children as they are running out of supplies because of the blockade. A global hunger monitor says already 500,000 are on the brink of starvation, and 1 million more have barely enough food to survive.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Hello, Bluey.
Talking with our pal Stuart J. Waddles. This is an episode of Bluey that Stuart turned me on to. I like this show so much. Would it be weird if I left my wife, remarried, and had kids with someone else just so I could watch Bluey with my new set of kids?
I don't think it'd be that weird. I've heard a weirder.
You have?
Make a great story.
You get the exclusive.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and data shows Wisconsin kids are in crisis. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The report from the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health shows the numbers have increased dramatically over the past 10 years. While rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm, and suicidal thoughts went up across the board, girls saw an overall higher increase. Wisconsin boys, however, are 2 to 4 times more likely to die by suicide than girls, according to the report. Amy Marsman says these trends are worse for LGBTQ+ students and students of color.
They feel less connected to their school and less likely to report that they feel they belong at their school. So we know that there are target populations that we should really focus on.
Marsman says teens are also getting less sleep than ever before, which is foundational to their mental health. More than 20% of teens reported self-harm, and nearly 25% of girls reported seriously considering suicide, according to the report. Marsman says factors like rising food insecurity, particularly among students of color, also play a significant role. She says additional support during the pandemic helped to eliminate food insecurity gaps, but now Black kids in Wisconsin are 5 times more likely to be hungry than white kids.
Some of these everyday situations really impact youth mental health, whether you're getting enough sleep, whether you are getting enough to eat, whether there's financial stability in your household. All of those are factors, and they are disproportionately impacting kids of color.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Our skies will clear out a bit today as a northeast wind develops. That cool breeze off the lake means highs in the middle 50s. Overnight, partly cloudy skies. Northeast winds continue with morning lows of the lower 40s. Clouds in lower 50s for your Monday. It's 57 at our studios.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend, including the state Republican convention with our friends at Wisconsin Watch and State Senator Royce on the Joint Finance Committee budget process. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Waukesha's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
My name is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus, a law review, our weekly weekend review and analysis of all things rule of law related, justice related, a lot of focus upon the government. This edition, no exception whatsoever. Noting importantly that we are recording this broadcast early, in part because of the significance of the subject matter, but also encouraging you, although you cannot call in while this broadcast is being heard throughout the radio broadcast breadth of Civic Media, do write down your questions. Write down your comments, your questions. I suspect there will be a lot of them, and we'll be sure to revisit those in our next live broadcast next weekend. We necessarily talk this broadcast about another major rule of law story that we have spent a lot of time talking about here on Amicus Law Review. Many of the other broadcast shows here on Civic Media, likewise focusing on the ways in which the rule of law doesn't just apply to things beyond our borders, not just out in Washington or in other places, the southwest border, other areas of our nation, but right here in Wisconsin, right here in our own neighborhoods. And it is important to take that lesson away, too, that these are not esoteric things. Yes, indeed, they sometimes get very complicated. We have necessarily had to undertake a national lesson, a series of classes, if you will, in how government works and how criminal constitutional procedure works to understand all of this. That's what this broadcast and others are all about. Let's talk about the application of some of those principles, yes, to the prosecution by the United States Department of Justice, your Department of Justice, of Wisconsin Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan. You know the facts of this. You know that just this past week, following up on the initial arrest of hers on a criminal complaint issued by a magistrate judge. We talked about that in great detail. That included charges, basically, that she illegally, according to the allegations, assisted an undocumented immigrant elude federal authorities, bringing that person outside of her courtroom. And based upon the allegations in that criminal complaint, she is arrested, as we know. She is brought to the federal courthouse. She is arraigned initially on that criminal complaint and released. Why? Because, as we have said at such great length, because it's the truth, she shouldn't have been arrested in the first place. She was not a risk of flight. She is not a danger to this community. We'll put on hold for now the question about whether or not even the charges against her truly are valid and will stand the tests of the judicial system. But we know that in the wake of that process, she is released. The Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, places her on administrative leave. They have not stripped her of her position. Administrative leave while all of this is pending. And we know as well that in the wake of the issuance of that criminal complaint,
It only stays in place for 30 days. And we know, once again, invoking the Constitution for the second time in this broadcast, that the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution requires what? That that if there indeed are charges to be brought, they can only be brought upon a presentment to a grand jury. Basically saying federal charges, well, yes, there is this process through the regulations and the statutes passed by Congress to establish and bring into the system someone on a criminal complaint. Ultimately, for charges to last, for charges to go forward, only a grand jury, 16 to 23 people reviewing the same evidence or more evidence or less evidence, can determine whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And they are the ones under our Constitution, according to what James Madison wrote all those many years ago. They're the ones who then issue an indictment, if at all. And indeed, that is what happened in the Eastern District of Wisconsin just this past week. A duly constituted, impaneled grand jury. They probably have worked on many other cases. We do not know about exactly what their tenure is, nor should they. The process, again, is in private. We do not know who they are. We do not know, at least to this time, exactly about their deliberations. What we do know, that there were witnesses brought in and out. We've seen some of those reported on in the local media. We know as well that the information provided to the grand jury in support of their finding that there is probable cause pretty much parallels what was in the criminal complaint. And so, indeed, when they issue this indictment earlier this week, the grand jury does find that there is probable cause to believe that the defendant here is, in fact, presumed innocent until proven guilty, but not proven guilty, nonetheless, a finding of probable cause that she has, in fact, engaged in violations of the federal law. Significantly, that's the routine progress. The point of the account and the significance of the event of this past week, certainly that she appears in front of the magistrate judge again, and at that time, various procedural things happen. She enters a plea of not guilty to the counts in the indictment against her, preserving her right to defend against them. And again, she has said through her lawyers that they are going to vigorously and effectively and very proactively, as they already have, going to be defending against the allegations against her in that indictment. She appears before the magistrate judge, and he takes her plea of not guilty and significantly, among other things, establishes a trial date. The trial date established is July 21 of, yes, this year. Highly unlikely that this case will go to trial by that time. There is a statute in the federal group of statutes, criminal procedure here, that prescribes that a defendant in the federal system who is charged by an indictment needs to be tried within 70 days of their initial appearance. The realistic aspect of this is that because of motions being filed, of other things, that is highly likely that July 21 date will move dramatically, certainly at a minimum into much later this year, maybe even into next year, as the parties now work in what's called this pre-trial era, this pre-trial stage of the proceedings. And indeed, what's that all about? Well, this is the time, again, when the government, again, by virtue of some obligations under some Supreme Court cases, is obliged appropriately to provide the defense with all the information it has. All the discovery is what it's called. All the documents, the reports of interviews, those other kinds of things that are necessary for the defense and will be a part of the prosecution. No surprises here. That's the idea. Let's tell, again, pursuant to the fundamental practices of our nation, let's tell the defendant what he or she has been charged with. Let's tell the defendant the bases upon which these charges are going to go forward. We're going to identify the witnesses, the documents, the events, the photographs, all the kinds of things that the defendant needs to know to prepare her or his defense. That's our system. And that is also prescribed effectively by an interpretation of our Constitution that goes back a very long time. So that happens. And that's presumably is underway right now. In addition, of course, the process contemplates the filing of motions. And yes, indeed, the government can file motions, things called motions in limine, motions that are going to be addressing various evidentiary issues related to the trial. They can do other things. And also, of course, those motions can be filed by the defense. And those motions can be in various ways. They can attack centrally the language of the indictment, saying, for example, that the very bones, the structure, within the four corners of the document, they do not allege a federal crime under the statutes. They can attack the language of the statute as being improper, as incomplete. They can go on to address other things significantly related to the conduct of the government in this matter. And I anticipate that probably those kinds of motions as well are forthcoming, not only in connection with the mechanisms through which Judge Dugan was initially arrested, but also the publication in the public domain of that photograph of her in handcuffs. All of that going to the conduct of the government, which can also be a subject of a motion to dismiss, to impose sanctions, to impose limitations. All kinds of things can be raised in this pretrial period by which the defense is appropriately putting the government to its proof, appropriately putting the government to come forward and explain exactly what its position is. And again, judges, magistrate judges initially, federal district court judges ultimately decide those motions. In this case, the case has been assigned, the trial has been assigned to Judge Lynn Edelman. I practice in front of him fairly routinely on both criminal and civil cases. He is a federal district court judge here in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And so as these motions come in, he will be the one, probably a first cut on them by the magistrate judge, but ultimately he will be deciding issues related to the substance of what this trial is going to look like. He will be deciding whether this case should be dismissed upon motions filed by the defense. He'll be deciding those motions filed by the government as well, all as this process, this due process, about which we've been talking about a whole lot recently. This is what it's all about. Let's not have any surprises. Let's tell everybody about the merits of the case. And then ultimately, in a court of law, in front of a jury, pulled in from the public, the community generally, they will determine whether or not the government has proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's where we are right now. And it is in that setting, one of the most significant things of the week has also happened. And that is that among the very first motions, it is actually the very first motion that counsel for defendant Hannah Dugan has filed even before the arraignment of this past week, right out of the gate, frankly, hours after the indictment is issued by the grand jury, the defendant, Hannah Dugan, through her attorney, file a motion to dismiss. And the upshot of this is in the first sentence. This is no ordinary criminal case, Judge Dugan says. The judge is no ordinary criminal defendant. And while the petition, the motion, the document filed with the court goes on to describe some of the events and circumstances that are described also in the complaint and also in the indictment, the reality is that this is a motion in which the defense says, before you get to any of those other petitions that go to the substance, maybe even the conduct of the government, take a look at this on its face and determine, judge, that two things are the case. Number one, that Hannah Dugan is immune from this prosecution by virtue of her being a Wisconsin Circuit Court judge. And second, that the concept of federalism under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution also precludes the government from prosecuting the case. When we come back, I'll tell you more about exactly what that motion says, why it's so important, and what we can anticipate again as this case proceeds here on Amicus, a law review.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee. 540 WAUK.
It's the Eco Minute powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. A major program that protects drinking water is on the chopping block in Congress. Lawmakers are considering slashing $2.4 billion from the state revolving fund. The program helps Wisconsin replace lead pipes and filter toxic contamination out of drinking water supplies. Our state will lose $54 million next year if funding gets cut. Parts of Wisconsin are being invaded this month by lake midges. Swarms of the insects have been rising from water bodies, including Lake Monona in Madison. The bugs can create quite a scene when they all hatch at once, but they are harmless and provide food for fish, bats, and birds. Knowledge is power. For a deep dive into environmental issues across Wisconsin, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Solaraview coming to you through the broadcast avenues of Civic Media, joined in the studio by my producer, wonderful support and outstanding production from Greg. And we are coming to you in a pre-recorded version today because of the significance of the things we're talking about. Two major stories, but some others coming up later in this, the second hour of Amicus Law Review, focusing right now on the content of this motion to dismiss right after the indictment is issued against Judge Hannah Dugan, Wisconsin Circuit Court judge, now in the federal system. She is a federal defendant in the federal district court in eastern Wisconsin. Her attorneys, even before the first appearance, and that's significant, because what they're saying to the judge is this is so important. This is such a threshold issue. By virtue of filing this, even before the first hearing in which a schedule for the filing of motions is established, even before that, they say, Judge, this is so important. You need to address this at the top. And again, Judge Adelman and the magistrate judge not going to resolve it right away. But the very timing of this motion to dismiss based upon its content is not lost on anyone. The motion itself says the problems with this prosecution are legion, but most immediately the government cannot prosecute the judge because she is entitled to judicial immunity for official acts. And goes on to say, interestingly, citing Trump versus United States from the pen of our Chief Justice that established for the first time in our nation's history that a president has immunities. Here, they're citing that very statute, that very order entered by our Supreme Court in support of the notion that Judge Dugan likewise benefits from judicial immunity when it comes to official acts. The motion says immunity is not just a defense to the prosecution to be determined later when those other motions are filed, but when the jury gets in front of the bar of the court and determines whether or not the proof is sufficient by a jury or court, it is an absolute bar at the start, at the outset. And that's what the point of this motion is all about. Not only is there immunity, but also federalism issues have to be resolved, the motion says, swiftly, because the government has no basis in law to prosecute her at all right out of the gate. Nothing more to be done here other than to bring this to a conclusion. That's the upshot of this motion to dismiss. And again, goes on to describe in a very intelligible and accessible 6-7 page motion. It is readable. It is digestible. It goes on to say that, you know, exactly what happened here, including her motives, her subjective motivations for doing what she allegedly did, they're irrelevant because judges are entitled to absolute immunity for their judicial acts without regard to the reasons that they did these things. We're not analyzing right now exactly what prompted her to do this, if indeed she did that. And in fact, since the early 17th century and carried on through common law in the United States, judges have been entitled to immunities that should apply here. The essence of immunity is its possessor's entitlement not to have to answer for their conduct in court. Why? Because as judges, you're immune from that. It's not just a defense to liability. Absolute immunity effectively prevents the prosecution from going ahead at all. And beyond that, the second piece, of course, of the motion focuses on the 10th Amendment. Now, I suspect that you all know what that is because you learned that in grade school, maybe beyond that, maybe in other civics and social studies classes. The 10th Amendment, again, says this: the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, by this very document in which the 10th Amendment appears, nor prohibited by it to the states in this document, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Anything not mentioned here, not specifically excluded, prohibited to the states, everything else the states have responsibility for, and so do you. And so the motion goes on to focus upon what it describes as the deeper, running deeper problems of the indictment. Immunities aside, the motion says, the indictment runs afoul of the 10th Amendment and constitutional principles of federalism. Again, this notion that we are divided into states and a federal government, and the federal government has great powers, but so do the states, and those powers, not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, are reserved to the states. That includes, the motion says, the general police power. The states retain it. The federal government, the motion says, does not have it. Unsurprisingly, then, the American judicial system empirically is almost entirely the realm of the states, and very much aware of that fact. Civil jurisdiction is limited. And that's why, for example, right in the middle of this motion, the defense attorneys say that's why we're 94% of criminal cases filed in this country are in state courts. That certainly is true of Wisconsin in the Eastern District as well. And the point here is just this. The motion goes on to say the government's prosecution here reaches directly into a state courthouse, not a federal courthouse, disrupting active proceedings, and it interferes with the official duties of an elective judge. A state defines itself as a sovereign through the structure of its government and the character of those who exercise government authority. Judge Dugan, the attorneys write, was elected by the people of Milwaukee County to adjudicate their disputes and administered what? The laws of Wisconsin. The federal government violated Wisconsin's sovereignty when it disrupted Judge Dugan's courtroom, and it is violating Wisconsin's sovereignty now with this very prosecution. The court should end the violation of Wisconsin's sovereignty and dismiss the indictment outright. As a practical matter, the attorneys go on to say, we stand ready to file briefs and to participate in an evidentiary hearing on this if the court feels that's necessary. But the reality is that this is so clear on its face, you don't have to get to any evidence as you look at the indictment. Dismiss this right now on the basis of immunity and the basis of a violation of federalism. That's the petition being made to Judge Adelman and the courts generally, barred by official acts of immunity and judicial immunity. Regardless, they go on to say, as this prosecution moves forward, she reserves her right. She will file more motions. And indeed, those are the kinds of motions that I described before. More is certainly coming if indeed Judge Adelman decides to deny this motion. But if he does grant this and says, you know what, you're right, Judge Dugan, federalism has been violated here by virtue of an overreach, and indeed you're immune from prosecution, one or both of those, he can dismiss this case outright. And Judge Adelman, as many of us in the legal community know, has always been intellectually acute and bright and focused, and he is open to those kinds of arguments that may seem on their face to be extraordinary, but in fact, in the end, are not. And so we'll look to see what Judge Adelman does with this motion as the litigation, the prosecution of Judge Hannah Dugan continues in the federal court here in eastern Wisconsin, as does this broadcast here on Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
CBS News Brief. The FBI says the man killed in the Palm Springs fertility clinic explosion was the bomber, who apparently was much too close for comfort.
We believe he was attempting to live stream it, and yes, that is also part of our investigation.
FBI Los Angeles Assistant Director Akil Davis says investigators are looking into a possible manifesto he may have left behind. Three states are cleaning up from tornadoes. None hit worse than Kentucky, where 18 people were killed. Emergency Management Director Eric Gibson says the damage is unspeakable.
The cleanup efforts are underway. There is great effort being made in that, but lots of work needs to be done.
The Secretary of State and Vice President Vance were at the Vatican to attend Pope Leo's installation and his first Mass. So are regular folks like Dominic Venditti of Seattle.
I like how emotional and kind he is. I love his background. I'm extremely happy to be here.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Another challenging year for the Badgers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports College Football. A report out this weekend says the Wisconsin Badgers will be lucky to finish 500 this season. Last year they went 5-7, and this year's schedule, not any easier. Alabama, Michigan, Ohio State, and an improved Indiana program. Most odds makers have the Wisconsin Badgers with another 5-7 record this fall. Baseball. The Brewers losing to the Twins last night, 7-0. Milwaukee with just three hits. The Twins have won 13 in a row and haven't allowed a scored run in 33 innings, a new franchise record. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
It's kind of indicative of how much they care, to be quite honest with you. I know people might not understand that. They care a great deal. They want to get it right. We also, guys, we faced a really good pitcher who was really good tonight.
The Twins' Pablo Lopez allowing just two hits in six innings. That series wrapping up today. From AmFam Field with Sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Our skies will clear out a bit today as a northeast wind develops. That cool breeze off the lake means highs in the middle 50s. Overnight, partly cloudy skies. Northeast winds continue with morning lows in the lower 40s. Clouds in lower 50s for your Monday. Currently 56 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. After the election of liberal-leaning Justice Janet Prosewitz in 2023, Wisconsin State Assembly and Senate maps were challenged in the Wisconsin Supreme Court and subsequently thrown out as unconstitutional. But justices passed on a challenge to the congressional districts. With April's election of Liberal Justice Susan Crawford, pro-voter groups are trying again for a fairer congressional voting map. In early 2024, the legislature ignored six fairer maps and adopted Democratic Governor Tony Evers' least change compromise map, later allowed to stand by the U.S. Supreme Court. GOP candidates were elected to six of eight congressional districts with only 50% of the statewide vote in 2024. Two challenges were filed May 7th and 8th, one by the Elias Group, contending that the Least Change Directive had no basis in the Wisconsin Constitution, and the second by the Campaign Legal Center, argues that Evers' map ignored traditional redistricting norms, splits too many counties, and didn't equally apportion the districts. A record $100 million was spent by both sides in the recent Wisconsin Supreme Court race. The current margin in the U.S. House is 220 Republicans to 213 Democrats. We've linked to the filings and local reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Matt and Air on Air.
Corrine Hendrickson, she owns a daycare center.
We're doing this day without childcare. What we do is we talk about what would happen, what would it look like if we didn't have childcare. But we also talk about what could it be? What can we do to change the system? I love all the protests. I love all the people speaking out against things. But we also need to participate in democracy by saying what we want and what we need and talk to our reps that way. So that's what this event is all about.
Catch Matt and Air on Air at its new time. Weekday mornings, 9 to 11 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Pat Kreitlow.
Pat's still on vacation, but he returns soon, we promise. But for now, we have the return of Bach and the Doc. Dr. Kristen Lierley sits in the big chair, and we go over all the news from the weekend. Join us
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a lot of you. We are pre-recorded this weekend, but we are talking about the major decisions and major actions in the areas of rule of law and justice in our nation, both in our nation's capital and right here in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Let's head west. Let's head west to a state court that happens to be in California, an issue that's percolating up for a long period of time, frankly, decades, candidly, but has reached a court resolution, at least in part, just this past week. Yes, indeed, this involves the decision by a Los Angeles judge, a state court judge, they're not federal court, to resentence Lyle and Eric Menendez to life with the possibility of parole. You know what this case is all about. In 1996, the Menendez brothers, you may recall this, maybe not, found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life imprisonment without parole for killing their parents, Jose, who's a music executive, and Mary Louise, her mother. Her name, she went by Kitty. It was their second trial at which they were found guilty of first-degree murder. 2 years earlier, a mistrial was declared after two separate juries, one for each brother impaneled, deadlocked on a verdict. The two trials proceeded very differently. Again, important to understand the significance, part of the reason I'm raising it, of pretrial decisions made by judges on motions that determine what's going to happen at a trial. In the first trial, defense lawyers on behalf of the Menendez brothers claimed that the brothers, you may know this well now based upon the news reporting, had killed their parents after years of what they described as sexual and physical and emotional abuse by their father, and that they feared for their lives. Basically, the defense of we did this because we need to defend ourselves against the criminal behavior and abusive behavior, the abusive behavior of their father. Their mother, they said, also knew about the abuse but didn't stop it. Interviews with the jurors after the mistrial revealed that some of them questioned how serious the abuse had been and to what extent it justified their actions. They, by that time, had admitted they did the murders early on during the course of the investigation. They said to authorities, "We know nothing about this." Eventually, they admitted that they did, in fact, kill their parents, but again, raised this defense of self-defense, effectively, based upon the things that their father was allegedly doing to them at the time. In the second trial, and this is the reason why this is so important, leading to their convictions. In that trial, the brothers were tried in front of a single jury, no longer bifurcated, no longer two juries for two brothers. Lawyers for the brothers were limited in what the evidence could be. The judge, his name is Stanley Weisberg, prohibited the lawyers in the second trial, unlike the first one, from using the abuse excuse, is what it was called at the time, essentially leaving for jurors only one of two options. Either you acquit them and you find that that defense is legitimate, or a murder conviction, and the jury went with the latter, convicted them and sentenced them again to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Well, of course, all kinds of things happen. You know some of that. We've got some evidence that has emerged in recent years. There's various documentaries talking about one of the members of Menudo came forward and said that, yes, Menendez had sexually assaulted him in the same family home. There are also these various Netflix projects, including a couple of programs, one of them called Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story, another one called The Menendez Brothers, that focused again upon what had happened way back when and whether or not indeed they were prompted to, whether this abuse excuse, as it was called at the time, is legitimate, and brought the public's attention back to Lyle and Eric Menendez, who again, spending their lives in prison. Along the way, it's significant to note that, yes, indeed, they have acknowledged that they killed their parents, but nonetheless continue to maintain that they were the victims of horrific sexual and physical abuse. While in prison, it is significant as well, that they did an awful lot of things, not only for their own rehabilitation, but reaching out and engaging with other defendants and other prisoners to improve their lives as well. The kinds of things they have done quite literally in the decades since they were convicted. And so what happens? After several hearings and several delays, just this past week, Lyle and Eric Menendez, again, not without a lot of procedural history involving two different district attorneys, were resentenced this past week to life with the possibility of parole, unlike their first sentence. They moved a step closer, therefore, to freedom after more than three decades behind bars for killing their parents. The decision by a judge, he's a Los Angeles state court judge. His name is Michael Jesic, J-E-S-I-C, of the Los Angeles Superior Court, now makes the brothers eligible to go before a parole board. So they're not in prison yet. Parole board can also now review whether or not they are entitled to be paroled. That's the reason why the things that they have done over the period of last three decades are important, whether they are contrite, whether they're acknowledging what they have done, even as they continue to maintain, as they do, that they were the victims of sexual and physical abuse at the hands of their father, their mother looking in the opposite direction. And a hearing has already been scheduled for next month on a separate clemency petition that's being considered by the governor of California. His name, as you know, is Gavin Newsom. The new Los Angeles district attorney, his name is Nathan Hochman, H-O-C-H-M-A-N. He was elected on promises to take a harder line on crime, had argued against a lighter sentence, and he opposed the position of the prior district attorney in support of a resentencing. Judge Jesic already rejected some multiple requests by D.A. Hochman to withdraw a sentencing petition that had been forwarded and advanced by the D.A.'s predecessor. And so the resentencing effort, the clemency petition, now the primary legal paths to leading perhaps to the brothers' freedom. In recent years, again, Lyle, who is now 57 years old, Eric is now 54, again, thrust back into the news not only by virtue of these social media defenders who have talked more about their cases, but also those TV series and documentaries and an awful lot of other presentations. And indeed, during the course of the hearings before the judge, people in support of their present release came forward, including family members. Acknowledging that the brothers had committed these acts, family members come forth and talk about the rehabilitation of the two brothers, describing that as exemplary, highlighted they created programs and counseled and mentored others inside the prison, pursued higher education behind bars, and others, again, come forward during the course of the hearing itself in support of their resentencing. All of that happening, again, underscoring a few different things here, underscoring, again, the importance of decisions made by judges in anticipation of trials. One wonders out loud if those decisions made by the trial judge the second trial around, if that judge at that time had permitted them to introduce evidence of their physical and sexual assault, if the result would have been different. Underscoring again the motions that are made by petitioners, by defendants, by the government as well in this pretrial setting. And then also the due process issue, which we talk about at great length. Here's another example of the systems that we have in place. In this case, they're all state related. The federal system has the same. State system, how does this work? Comes upon a petition, right, of now a former district attorney, not embraced by the present district attorney, but you've got a judge who independently pretty much says, I want to do this. I want to explore what the prior district attorney has presented to me. He has a hearing, an evidentiary hearing. He hears from witnesses. He understands more about what the brothers in this case have done for the past 30 years. They talk more about the merits of what happened during the course of their time in prison, the good things that they have done even while they have been incarcerated, plainly revisiting as well the horrific events involving the murders of their parents 30 years ago. And the judge in the end makes a determination that they should be sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, which again opens up more due process for them, right? And that process includes, again, review by a parole board and other matters that could indeed follow in the wake of that important decision made just this past week. The Menendez brothers, not yet freed, now in the hands of the parole board. Clemency petition also pending, but nonetheless, an underscoring of the possibility, even as our sensibilities to things like sexual assault and physical abuse, as those change over time, things that we may have decided on differently decades ago can be revisited. Not always with success, not always with clarity in terms of the way that the results are accomplished, but nonetheless, that's what our system is about. Advocates for, final point, the notion that the law needs to be vibrant and needs to be responsive to contemporary understandings of justice and truth and decency and humanity and all those good things, a living and breathing law, including the Constitution of the United States of America, the Constitution of the State of California, and indeed the Constitution of Wisconsin as well. All of that, all of those lessons coming out of the Menendez matter, now back in the administrative system, the judicial system, the parole system there in the state of California. Let's go back once again to Washington, D.C., and indeed yet another executive order that is significant when it comes to humanity and decency and understanding how it is that our civil rights enforcement in this nation should proceed. We know, because we've talked about this in prior editions of Amicus Law Review, that there are concerns about what's going on right now inside the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, often said by other attorneys general of all parties, from presidents, both Republican and Democratic, that if you look to the Civil Rights Division and you figure out what they're doing and all the important assignments given them, that gives you some sense about the vitality, the heart, the lifeblood of the Department of Justice generally. Why is that important? Why do they say that? It's because the Civil Rights Division handles so many things that affect so many people. The other divisions also, absolutely, they're also significant. The Criminal Division, the Civil Division, the Environmental Division, tax, all kinds of things out there, national security, antitrust division, all hugely important. But the Civil Rights Division, what do they focus on? They focus on things like voting rights, voting in America, ensuring that the Voting Rights Act is enforced, housing, the Fair Housing Act is enforced. Yes, indeed, the Civil Rights Act, also of the mid-1960s, signed by Lyndon Johnson, that gives so many provisions, so in the statutory codification there by Congress, that ensures that in employment and access to so many parts of our national experience, that people are treated with decency and their civil rights are enforced. They do all of those kinds of things inside the Civil Rights Division. They also do things related to policing in America. These are the folks who also determine if indeed there's a basis to do a local specific review of the conduct of a policing entity, a sheriff's department, a city policing agency, if they're arresting in a way, if they're imposing fines in a way, if they're enforcing the law in a way that's contrary to our Constitution. It is the Civil Rights Division that comes in, as it did here in Milwaukee and in other cities around the nation in recent times, doing assessments and either suing to get those remedies that are needed or also engaging in consent decrees to ensure that those things are remedied. That's the kind of stuff that the Civil Rights Division does. It is huge, enforcing disability rights, enforcing rights of LGBTQIA citizens, enforcing rights that are familial in nature, all kinds of things. Religious freedoms, a capacity to engage in the freedom to observe your faith as you choose, all of that. So many things that we pull from the Bill of Rights are enforced by the Civil Rights Division. Concerning that the Civil Rights Division recently is seeing a huge departure from its ranks of attorneys who traditionally have done that work. Plainly, those vacancies would be filled by an attorney general who has identified a different kind of commission for that unit within inside the Department of Justice. She is also taking her guidance from an executive order issued by the president recently. When we come back, I'll tell you about something else that President Trump has done to strip away a legal tool that has been key to civil rights enforcement for a long, long time in America. All of that here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The biggest thing that happens in Wisconsin state government every 2 years is the state budget. And last week at the state capitol, Republican lawmakers took a step forward in the process by voting out more than 600 measures from Governor Tony Evers' budget proposal. This has become a familiar step in this era of divided government. This is now the fourth budget proposal that Evers has put forward, and each one has been met with a similar fate. Even as this has become the custom, it doesn't have to be this way. Republicans could honestly engage with this budget and debate it on its merits. There are good, smart proposals here on everything from healthcare to education to childcare to environmental protection. And if there are items here they disagree on, make the case. Have the debate. But by voting everything out and starting from scratch, they are letting down the people of Wisconsin they are elected to represent by refusing to have this debate on a very basic level. We should expect better.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Waukesha's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, joined here in the studios of Civic Media by Greg, my outstanding producer. We are finishing up in this, our last segment, that does not include in this edition of Amicus your questions, your comments, but soliciting those in our next weekend's broadcast. Keep those in mind, and we will follow up on that, especially about this story, which finishes out our presentation, our program this weekend. And it has to do with one of those executive orders among the tens of them that have been issued by the president up to this time, little noticed. Issued last month with a spate of other orders targeting equity policies. This one, President Trump ordering federal agencies, including especially the Department of Justice, to abandon the use of a longstanding legal tool. And it is the concept of disparate impact. I'll explain that in just a moment. Disparate impact liability to root out discrimination against minorities. And it is undeniably a huge shift. Again, presumably adopted by an assistant attorney general in the Civil Rights Division who will follow this directive. In his expansive order, Donald Trump directed the federal government to curtail the use of this disparate impact liability theory. It has been and remains in many sectors a core tenet. It's used by for decades to enforce the Civil Rights Act way back from 1964. By determining whether policies and practices of governments and other entities disproportionately disadvantage certain groups. Okay, it's very key. The disparate impact test, crucial in enforcing key portions of all those acts I described before, including prohibitions on federal funding, discriminating based on race and color, national origin. For decades and decades, it has been relied upon by the government and, yes, by your Department of Justice to root out those discriminatory practices in, once again, housing, education, policing, basic access to the trappings of life, employment, all kinds of things. Prosecutors like me and others who, again, also did quite a bit of civil litigation as well. I will tell you, the disparate impact test is one of the most important tools for uncovering discrimination because it shows how a seemingly neutral policy, something that on its face may not strike you or even me as being discriminatory or violative of the law, somehow is a different outcome. In practice, when this seemingly neutral policy is put in place, it has a different outcome for different demographic groups. And it reveals the inequities by virtue of the impact, thus the name disparate impact, upon groups. It is crucial in showing how criminal background and credit checks affect employment of black people, for example. How physical capacity tests inhibit employment opportunities for women. How zoning regulations could violate fair housing laws. how schools in the education setting have meted out overly harsh discipline to minority students and children with disabilities, all because seemingly superficial and non-discriminatory policies have a disparate impact, an irregular impact upon certain communities. That's what this is all about. And so, of course, it has been attacked for a long period of time, but it has also been endorsed across the way, universally. We know that the executive order, which is likely to face challenges now pushing back on this, limiting its application, falsely claimed that the disparate impact test is unlawful. And the order goes on to say it violates the Constitution. In fact, that's just plain wrong, Mr. President. The measure was codified, actually put in legislation by Congress in 1991, and it was been upheld by the Supreme Court. Yes, the same Supreme Court, the same entity we're talking a lot about on this broadcast. As recently as what? 2015, 10 years ago, they endorsed and embraced this notion, this doctrine that has animated and led to remedial results that ensure that the American experience is accessible to everyone. Vital tool, the Supreme Court said, in the work of protecting civil rights, cited in a December 2024 dissent. By who? By Justice Sam Alito. Sam Alito embraced it in 2024, and now our president has said that, in fact, it needs to be abandoned and discredited. He has said, for example, in this order, he calls it the Restoring Equality of Opportunity and Meritocracy. It echoes plainly those arguments he's made about the country becoming too focused on its racist history, and the protections from the civil rights era now have led to reverse racism against non-minority groups. We have seen that a lot, not only from the president, but others. And the concept here, of course, is that our civil rights law necessarily need to apply to everyone, and that disparate impact theory, that doctrine, should be applied. Instead, the president said, disparate impact liability is a part of a pernicious movement, he said. It seeks to transform America's promise of equal opportunity into a divisive pursuit of results preordained by irrelevant, immutable characteristics, regardless of individual strengths, effort, or achievement. That's what the president wrote when he issued this executive order. I would offer that people of all political views and perspectives should abandon, should reject, should say that that language alone is not only offensive, it's contrary to what our nation is all about. And indeed, we are a nation of people of diversity, people with immutable characteristics. They're set forth in the laws of our nation, our employment laws, our housing laws, our voting laws. All the laws that are passed, they embrace the fact that people of immutable characteristics makes us strong, and those actually improve our strengths, our achievements, and our efforts to achieve something that's important to the American experience. Nonetheless, Donald Trump, again, in this executive order, certainly to be attacked. This will go into federal court as well, and it will be challenged, as will all the others. And as a part of our injunction function aspect of this broadcast, we'll tell you more about what happens to this and all those other executive orders that continue to animate much of our focus here on Amicus Law Review, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good weekend, everybody.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee. 540 WAUK.
Maggie Dawn.
At 4:30, I'm joined by Benga Ajilore, a former advisor with the USDA, talking about the threats to rural hospitals posed by the Republican budget reconciliation.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You want to feel important. You want to be a part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things. You want to feel like you belong. We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it. We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers. We are normal people just like you. And together, we can make a difference. Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun.
It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. The FBI says the man who planned and detonated the bomb outside a Palm Springs fertility clinic was the only person killed in the explosion. The FBI's Los Angeles Assistant Director, Akil Davis, says first responders' quick action paid off, not just in saving lives.
We were able to save all of the embryos at this facility. Good guys one, bad guys zero.
Palm Springs Police Chief Andrew Mills says while the investigation continues,
I am absolutely confident that this city is safe. There is no continuing threat to our community as a result of this incident.
It's a long road ahead in Somerset, Kentucky, hit hard by a tornado that left a large swath of damage and death. Officials say 17 of the 18 Kentuckians who were killed in the tornado were from there. Emergency Management Director Eric Gibson.
There's entire subdivisions that are leveled or nearly leveled. Many, many houses in the subdivisions that I visited yesterday are destroyed. The homes are just a few walls standing or no walls standing.
The turbulent weather is blamed for 27 deaths in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia. Investigators are trying to find out exactly why a tall ship collided with New York's Brooklyn Bridge last night. The fire department's first reports of trouble sounded like this. Audio courtesy of Broadcastify.
Looks like a sailboat was going under the Brooklyn Bridge. Hit something over there with the mast broken off and is drifting under the Manhattan Bridge with people on the boat.
New York Senator and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Trump administration Coast Guard cutbacks might have played a role.
There are many more questions than answers as to how the accident occurred and whether it could have been prevented.
Two crew members were killed, 19 injured.